Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you an Advent special. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by setting the Advent mood with one of the great hymns for this time of hope in the liturgical year. It's one of Charles Wesley's, who was born exactly 300 years ago. As you know, he was one of the founders of Methodism and wrote literally thousands of hymns, many of which are still a vital part of Christian worship around the world. Hymns like Hark, the Herald Angels Sing, Christ the Lord is Risen Today, Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing, and Love Divine or Love's Excelling, just to name but a few. But also, Come Thou Long Expected Jesus, an Advent hymn I'd like to begin this programme with, specifically with the third verse, one I find particularly moving. Now I've set the Advent mood, let's join renowned author and theologian, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, for a seasonal reflection, as he too picks up on the theme of hope, reflecting all the while on Pope Benedict XVI's recent encyclical, Spe Salvi.
Advent is a time when we think about God, about the God who's coming to us. I think a lot about that lovely phrase that recurs in the book of Revelation, God is the God who is, who was, and who is to come. The author of that wonderful last book of the Bible doesn't say the God who is, who was, and who will be. No, the God who is, who was, and who is to come. And that puts a stress on the future, the futurity of God. God is the God who's coming to us. In his encyclical, Saved by Hope, the Holy Father has some lovely reflections about the God who is to come in judgment. And judgment is not a terrifying thing, but it's a thing we can welcome and look forward to. We look forward to the birth of Jesus liturgically, but we also look forward to the last judgment. And God is going to see that justice is done. The world is full of so much injustice and suffering, and yet are we going to forget all that? But no, God is not going to forget all that. God is going to really see that, not in a vindictive way, that justice is done, that the victims have the last word, not the perpetrators of outrages. And I found it marvellous in that section of his encyclical that the Holy Father drew on two great Jewish scholars from Frankfurt, Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, who really didn't come to Christian faith, but they asked the right question. Are the perpetrators going to triumph over the victims? And they said that cannot be. They asked the question, in Jesus we have the answer, that the justice is going to be vindicated and last judgment is something to look forward to with great joy and hope. And I was so pleased to see the Holy Father in his encyclical bringing out that theme about the last judgment. So often we can think of the last judgment as something terrifying, you know, will I go to heaven or hell? No, but he thinks of it as a time when justice will be done and will be seen to be done for everybody. I think Advent also is a time of thinking about justice, but also making a leap of faith like the Blessed Virgin Mary. She couldn't rehearse, practice that scene when Gabriel came to her. There was the question out of the blue, and thank God she answered right. I mean, she never practiced that, but she really came through with colours flying. Well, we don't always do that, but let's try to do it. Let's try to imitate her and come through saying yes to God in faith and in hope. I think Advent is a time of welcoming. The Holy Fathers produced the encyclical on the 30th of November, and on the 14th of December, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith works for him. They produce a document on evangelization. And that's a lovely document for Advent too, because they say we have such good news and we should share it with everybody, that Jesus is sheer good news and we shouldn't keep him to ourselves, but let others know about it through our example, but also through our words.
Warm thanks there to theologian Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins for sharing with us this seasonal reflection. And finally, as we approach Christmas, a mile mark for another year suggesting thoughts of joy, it's time for another programme which takes us towards the 25th of December. One in which, as always, our colleague Jill Bevilacqua darts about, bringing us a miscellany of seasonal readings, which offer a vision of how Christmas has evolved over the centuries. So stay tuned and find out what Jill has to offer exactly. Without giving too much away, she'll be bringing us a selection of letters and poems, touching on the sinister war years, on descriptions of today's secular mood, announced by that expression, run up to Christmas instead of Adventide.
Many years ago, I received a Christmas card from an Italian friend containing some thoughts on Christmas I've never forgotten, and which I'd like to share with you now. The writer, Giovanni Papini, was commenting on these lines from the Cherubic Pilgrim by a 17th century German Protestant, Angelo Silesius, who became a Catholic and a friar minor. Silesius had written, "One of the most profound things I have ever heard said about Christianity is this. If Christ were to be born 1,000 or even 10,000 times in Bethlehem, it will profit nothing if he is not born at least once in your heart." And here is Papini's comment.
But how can this interior birth come about? Our soul is often like a stable. It's so narrow and dark and so encumbered with filth that it doesn't seem that there can be room for a God, even though he be a child. And yet this new miracle is not impossible, as long as it's wished for and expected. The day when you don't feel a touch of bitterness and of jealousy at the joy of your enemy or of your friend, rejoice, because it's a sign that that birth is near. The day when you don't feel a secret touch of pleasure at the misfortune or the fall of others, console yourself, because the birth is near. The day when you feel the need to bring a little joy to whoever is sad, and the impulse to lighten the sorrow or distress of even one single creature, be glad, because God is due to arrive at any moment. And if one day you're afflicted and persecuted by misfortune, and lose your health and strength, children and friends, and you have to put up with the stupidity, the malice, and the coldness of those who are near and those who are far, but despite all, you don't give way to complaints or blasphemies, and you accept your destiny with a calm mind, exult and triumph, because the marvel that seemed impossible has come about, and the Saviour has already been born in your heart. You are no longer alone. You will never be alone again. The darkness of your night will shine as if 1,000 comets had arrived from every point of the sky to celebrate the meeting of your brief human day with divine eternity.
The poem you will hear next is not well known, and although I learnt it as a child, I never came across it again until a few years ago, when I bought a second-hand copy of All the Puck Stories by Rudyard Kipling. And lo and behold, there it was, Eddie's Service. The poem immediately precedes a short story entitled The Conversion of St. Wilfrid. Wilfrid was that forceful Northumbrian saint who, we may read, worked zealously to substitute Roman for Celtic discipline in various matters, with notable success at the Synod of Whitby. That was the famous occasion when the Roman calculation of Easter was made obligatory and the Celtic custom abolished. And Eddie? Well, it seems he was a monk named Edius Stephanus, who had been a precentor at Canterbury, and was taken up by Wilfrid, helping him to establish the use of Roman chant in all the churches of the north. He became Wilfrid's friend, and eventually also his biographer. His life of Wilfrid, in fact, was the basis of Bede's own life of the saint, written a decade or more later. Kipling's poem, at first sight, seems no more than a charming fantasy, which it is, but the setting is not so. Kipling, who lived in Sussex, knew all about Wilfrid, who had spent 5 years there, and, as even the guidebook tells us, established Christianity among the South Saxons here in 681. But let's listen to the poem.
Eddie, priest of St. Wilfrid in the chapel at Manhood End, ordered a midnight service for such as cared to attend. But the Saxons were keeping Christmas, and the night was stormy as well. Nobody came to the service, though Eddie rang the bell. "Wicked weather for walking," said Eddie of Manhood End, "but I must go on with the service for such as care to attend." The altar candles were lighted. An old marsh donkey came, bold as a guest invited, and stared at the guttering flame. The storm beat on at the windows, the water splashed on the floor, and a wet, yoke-weary bullock pushed in through the open door. How do I know what is greatest? How do I know what is least? "That is my father's business," said Eddie, Wilfrid's priest. "But three are gathered together. Listen to me and attend. I bring good news, my brethren," said Eddie of Manhood End. And he told the ox of a manger and a stall in Bethlehem, and he spoke to the ass of a rider that rode to Jerusalem. They steamed and dripped in the chancel. They listened and never stirred, while just as though they were bishops, Eddie preached them the word. Till the gale blew off on the marshes, and the windows showed the day, and the ox and the ass together wheeled and clattered away. And when the Saxons mocked him, said Eddie of Manhood End, "I dare not shut his chapel on such as care to attend."
We know Eddie existed, and Wilfrid too, of course, but Manhood End? It sounds like a poetic invention. But no. If we turn to Arthur Mee's book on Sussex, we find this, under the heading Selsey, the fertile peninsula where Wilfrid preached.
"The farthest south of Sussex, it was once an island, Seal's Island, but it ceased to be an island long ago and became part of Manhood Peninsula, with Selsey Bill as its farthest point. The sea is eating it away at about 6 feet a year, and the raised beach of soft silver sand is vanishing. St. Wilfrid built his cathedral here, and it's the Venerable Bede who tells us that when St. Wilfrid landed at Selsey, he first won the sympathy of its people by teaching them to fish, and then converted the delighted fishermen and persuaded them to build a cathedral. Here he built his first monastery in Sussex, and monastery and cathedral flourished side by side for about 400 years. Today the cathedral lies under the sea, and the monastery with it. A few stones have come up in the fishing nets, and there are fragments of carving and a magnificent font which may have seen the last days of Wilfrid's shrine. Another church was built in the 13th century, and a new one in the 19th, made with the stones of the old."
And so the story goes on. For some of the Saxon carvings have survived and may be seen in the great cathedral at Chichester, 8 miles away along a winding road. But as the guidebook tells us, overlooking Pagham Bay and its nature reserve is the romantic St. Wilfrid's Chapel. For yes, as Arthur Mee found, the little chancel of the 13th century church still stands complete. For how long, one wonders, for the sea is drawing relentlessly nearer, year by year. Back in 1875, the area was drained, only, writes Mee, to be reclaimed by the waves in 1910. and not many generations have passed since the spray of the sea came over the wall of the churchyard. It's hardly surprising that there's a nature reserve here today, with mud flats, salt marsh and grazing marsh, for the trend now is towards the recuperation of our wetlands. How Hopkins would have rejoiced. And maybe one day it will all be marshland again, as it was in Eddie's time. But before then, the chapel of Wilfrid's priest will probably have long been submerged, and it will indeed seem only part of a charming fantasy. And from that rather nostalgic little piece of history, we turn to the more prosaic present, and how the vision of Christmas has evolved, or faded, depending on your point of view. "The Saxons were keeping Christmas," wrote Kipling, meaning, of course, that they were so busy merrymaking they had no time for going to church. And though we may do our utmost to concentrate on the true meaning of Christmas, we cannot ignore the fact that the sacred aspect of the feast occupies a very small part of it. A note on Advent in the Chambers Book of Days is revealing.
In the Christian Church, the weeks preceding Christmas are collectively known as Advent, celebrating the coming of Christ. In our increasingly secular society, this period is simply known as the run-up to Christmas. But excited children still use Advent calendars to count off the days. These typically take the form of a brightly coloured Christmassy scene with 24 doors, one to be opened each day from the 1st of December to the 24th of December, revealing a picture or some other treat behind the numbered flap.
Some other treat often takes the form of a mini bar of chocolate. And while no one would wish to deprive children of a treat, one wonders just how many of them have any idea what Advent means. Oh yes, of course, the run-up to Christmas. But, carping aside, the secular Christmas is a reality that's here to stay. Months before the day, we're informed of the exact number of shopping days to Christmas. Shopping, that's what it's all about. Let's hear what it was like back in 1913. It was, we read, a glorious and exciting Christmas.
The post had reached the unexampled total of 26 million cards and letters. The Christmas shopping had broken all records. The cold and misty evenings had but enhanced the lure of the brightly lit shop windows. Everyone seemed to be in cheerful spirits. The crowds in the main shopping thoroughfares of the West End grew greater each day, reaching their maximum on Christmas Eve, when the streets were congested with a slowly moving mass of every kind of vehicle and vast throngs of shoppers threading their way past the huge plate-glass windows with their imposing display of goods.
That was how it was in 1913, the last Christmas of peace, before the outbreak of the First World War. A quarter of a century later, it all started again. But the first 6 months of the Second World War were strangely quiet. As Churchill wrote,
"The armies gaped at each other from behind their rising fortifications across an undisputed no-man's land."
It was what the American journalist dubbed the phony war. Churchill called it a sinister trance. And so, that year, Christmas went on as usual. Even more so, it seems, as Norman Longmate writes in How We Lived Then.
"Christmas trade in 1939 was 10% up on 1938, despite higher taxes and the government's appeal to save. Apart from the blackout, the chief reminders of the war were the toy soldiers' uniforms on sale in the toy shops and some topical jokes in the Christmas pantomimes, like the explanation for an offstage crash in Cinderella. That must be Goring changing his medals."
So let's listen to this light-hearted extract from novelist Jan Struthers' Mrs. Miniver, which was published in 1939. The lady in question, a middle-aged housewife, has just come to the end of a long day of Christmas shopping. Clutching her parcels, she makes her way through the crowds towards her car. After the overheated atmosphere of the shops, she braces herself for the impact of the real winter world outside.
"There was a raw wind. Sleety rain was beginning to fall, blurring the lamplight. The pavements were sealed slick. It was settling down into one of those nasty wet evenings, which the exiled Londoner longs for with a quite unbearable nostalgia. She tumbled all her parcels into the back of the car, slid happy but exhausted into the driving seat and set off. Getting home was evidently going to be a long job. The usual 6 o'clock home-going stream was in spate with Christmas crowds, and Oxford Street was a solid jam. It was her own fault, she had to admit, as she sat back and waited for the lights to change. Every year the same thing happened. At the beginning of November she made up her mind that this time, for once, she would get her Christmas shopping done early. She went as far as writing out a list, and there, for several weeks, the matter rested. At intervals, she tried to pretend that Christmas Day fell on the 5th of December, or alternatively, that all her friends and relations lived in South Africa and that she had to catch an early mail. But it was no use. The feeling of temporal urgency cannot be artificially produced, any more than the feeling of financial distress. The rich young man who determines to work his way around the world may gain many things, but the experience of poverty is not one of them. He knows that in the ultimate emergency, he can always cable home for funds, and Mrs. Miniver knew perfectly well that Christmas was not until the 25th of December, and that all the people on her list lived in England. Besides, successful present choosing depends very largely upon the right atmosphere, upon the contagious zest of crowds, upon sudden inspirations and perceptions, heightened rather than otherwise by a certain sense of pressure in space and time. To do it cold-bloodedly in a half-empty shop, without any difficulty or competition, is as joyless as a mariage de convenance. So perhaps it was just as well, she told herself consolingly, that she had, as usual, left it till the middle of December.
Before our final reading, perhaps you'd listen to these words I came across recently, but which had been printed on a Christmas card once, and appeared here in what must have been the centre page of a small magazine. The message was a series of questions, but unfortunately the opening was missing, so I filled in what seemed to have been the first few words of what was perhaps the first question. All the rest was there.
Are you willing to accept that it's not what you're going to get out of life, but what you're going to put into it? To close your book of complaints about the management of the universe and to look around for a place where you can sow a few seeds of happiness? Are you willing to do these things, even for a day? Then you can keep Christmas. Are you willing to stoop down and consider the needs and the desires of little children? To remember the weakness and lowliness of people who are growing old? To stop asking how much your friends love you and ask yourself whether you love them or not? Are you willing to bear in mind the things that other people have to bear in their hearts? To try to understand what those who live in the same house with you really want, without waiting for them to tell you? Are you willing to make a grave for your ugly thoughts and a garden for your kindly feelings with the gate wide open? Are you willing to do these things even for a day? Then you can keep Christmas. Are you willing to believe that love is the strongest thing in the world, stronger than hate, stronger than evil, stronger than death, and that the blessed life which began in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago is the image and brightness of the eternal love? Then you can keep Christmas. And if you can keep it for a day, why not keep it always?
Our last choice is a poem by Sir John Betjeman, England's Poet Laureate from 1972 until his death in 1984. Betjeman was a great lover of churches, especially old ones, and he campaigned tirelessly to save those destined for destruction. So when the centenary of his birth fell in the summer of 2006, church bells rang all over England to celebrate this most popular of poets. It's fitting, then, to conclude our Christmas selection this year with Betjeman's poem entitled simply Christmas.
The bells of waiting Advent ring, and tortoise stove is lit again, and lamp oil light across the night has caught the streaks of winter rain in many a stained glass window sheen, from Crimson Lake to Hooker's Green. The holly in the windy hedge and round the manor house the yew will soon be stripped to deck the ledge, the altar, font and arch and pew, so that the villagers can say, "The church looks nice on Christmas Day." Provincial public houses blaze and corporation tramcars clang. On lighted tenements I gaze where paper decorations hang. And bunting in the red town hall says, "Merry Christmas to you all." And London shops on Christmas Eve are strung with silver bells and flowers as hurrying clerks the city leave to pigeon-haunted classic towers. And marbled clouds go scudding by the many-steepled London sky. And girls in slacks remember Dad, and oafish louts remember Mum. And sleepless children's hearts are glad, and Christmas morning bells say, "Come!" Even to shining ones who dwell safe in the Dorchester Hotel. And is it true? And is it true? This most tremendous tale of all, seen in a stained glass window's hue, a baby in an ox's stall, the maker of the stars and sea, become a child on earth for me? And is it true? And is it true? For if it is, no loving fingers tying strings around those tissued fripperies, the sweet and silly Christmas things, bath salts and inexpensive scent and hideous tie so kindly meant. No love that in a family dwells, no caroling in frosty air, nor all the steeple-shaking bells can with this single truth compare, that God was man in Palestine and lives today in bread and wine.
You've been listening to a programme presented by Jill Bivilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voice you also heard, along with Jill's and on one occasion Linda Bordone's. And before we end, let's hear Charles Wesley's great Advent hymn, "Come, Thou Long Expected Jesus," once again. And that's all we have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this programme. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.